So this one will be on the subject of the heterotic string. And this is a string phenomenology workshop, but I'm going to start this talk with phenomenology and work my way to string theory. Okay? So the topics that we're going to discuss are phenomenology, orbifold guts, and then we'll get to the heterotic string. And the work that I'm going to discuss here is based on three papers, essentially. One which was done by Kobayashi, Zhang, and myself a couple of years ago. And then two recent papers. This one will appear on the web hopefully tomorrow. And then this one should appear on the web within a week or so. So first we're going to discuss the phenomenology. The phenomenology that I'm going to talk about has to do with charge quantization, gauge coupling unification, Yukawa unification, and neutrino masses, and I'm leading you along a primrose path here to the subject of grand unification. Here are the quarks and leptons of the standard model. I normalized my hypercharge such that electromagnetism is T3 left plus Y over 2, and you know the hypercharges of these states are kind of crazy, 1/3, minus 4/3, 2/3, etc. So there's crazy charge assignments, and you don't quite understand from the standard model why you should have particles with these crazy charge assignments. However, it was shown by Patty Salomon around 1973 that you can put all of these particles together if you include one new particle, a sterile neutrino or right-handed neutrino. I call it sterile because it has no standard model quantum numbers. It's SU3 cross SU2 and U1 singlet, or zero charge under hypercharge. Anyway, you put these particles together, and then you can define an SU4 color symmetry, which combines leptons with quarks. And these right-handed, or these left-handed, these, the notation here is a Biot spinner notation, so these are all left-handed particles. So these are particles of left-handed antiparticles. Okay, these are the fields which create left-handed antiparticles, and you can put them all into one anti-quark, super-quark multiplet, which includes the right-handed leptons and the right-handed up and down quarks, and they transform as a doublet under SU2 right. So these are a doublet under SU2 left and SU2 right singlets. These are doublet under SU2 right and SU2 left singlets. And these are fours and four bars of SU4. And it's a very compact notation, and it's a non-abelian unification of these particles. And so hypercharge now has to come out of the non-abelian symmetries. In fact, B minus L is just the symmetry, the part of SU4 when you break it down to SU3, which distinguishes quarks from leptons. And you have a generator which is 1, 1, 1 minus 3. And that's B minus L divided by, or B minus L up to a factor. And then tau 3 right is included here to give you ordinary hypercharge. So the hypercharge assignments are just coming from this simple combination of charges. And if you take Y over 2 and put this together, you get a left-right symmetric definition of electromagnetism, because electromagnetism is just T3 left plus T3 right plus a half B minus L. So it's a very simple compact formula which puts everybody together into two irreducible representations of the Patty Salam group. Now, Patty Salam is not the end of the story. In fact, it was shown, the history of this is that SU5 was discovered by Georgi shortly after he had discovered SO10, but they presented, Georgi Glashow presented SU5. Because they knew of Patty Salam already, and they knew that Patty Salam was a subgroup of SO10. At any rate, whether that's true or not, you have SO10 here. It can be broken up in SU5 cross a U1 or Patty Salam subgroups. The spinner representation, the 16-dimensional representation of SO10, then contains in the Patty Salam notation the Q and the Q bar. They're just the two irreducible representations that come out of the spinner representation of SO10. In SU5 language, you know that you get a 10, a 5 bar, and the singlet with these these U1 assignments. Now, I'm going to show you the next notation that you're probably all familiar with. This is Cartan-Weyl notation for the weights of these states. So the 16 and 16 bar can be described by these. This is rank 5 group, SO10. So you can describe it by plus or minus a half quantum numbers. and the even ones, by, in my definition, are this defined. The even number of minus signs gives you the 16 of SO10, and the odd number of minus signs in this notation gives you the 16 bar representation of SO10. The 45-dimensional representation, or the adjoint representation of SO10 in Cartan-Weil notation, is just the either plus, plus, minus, minus, or minus, plus, and that's how you move along in this weight space for the 16 by using the adjoint representation. And this line underneath just tells you that you have to take all permutations of where you put the plus and minus ones in the five slots, and that gives you the 40 non-zero roots of SO10. And then finally, the 10-dimensional representation of SO10 is given by the single vector, where you again permute where you put the plus or minus one. Question?
Something quick. So the two different, well, the ways you embed the standard model are equivalent completely in these two different approaches?
Yes.
Okay.
Another way of saying the spinner representation can be written in terms of a tensor product of five spin a half states. What I had on the previous slide is equivalent in pictorial language to what I have here, but now I've also identified the hypercharge of the states. The hypercharge of the states in SO10 language is just 2/3 times the sum of the color spins, where you think of the first three spin a half tensor products as color spins, plus or minus a half. And the last two are the weak spins, and so hypercharge is just 2/3 the sum of the color spins minus the weak spins. And now using that assignment, you can get the actual hypercharge assignments of all of these particles, and you can see explicitly how the SU5 and SO10 adjoint representation is acting on this multiplet. The SU5 representations are just raising and lowering adjacent or non-adjacent spins. That would take you, leave you with the same number of minus signs. So these all have two minus signs. This is the 10-dimensional representation of SU5. This is the 5-bar representation of SU5. It has four minus signs. And by raising and lowering a spin index, you can't go out of that subset. And finally, this is the sterile neutrino that's up here, which is an SU5 singlet. However, the SO10 action also allows you for raising two spins or lowering two spins, and then you can go from the 10 to the 5 bar, et cetera. Questions?
Can you embed,
flipped SU5 and SO10, and then I would have to identify hypercharge in a way which is not equivalent to the standard SU5 assignment. And then hypercharge would come out of a linear combination of what's in SU5 and what's in that U1. Okay, next step is gauge coupling unification. That's charge quantization. It's all very easily understood in terms of this one irreducible representation of SO10. Gauge coupling unification works. I mean, I don't want to say more about that. You take the three low energy gauge couplings, you use low energy supersymmetry, you renormalize up to the gut scale, including those supersymmetric particles, and you find a gut scale at two loops is around 3 times 10 to the 16 GeV. So that works nicely. What about question? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Gauge coupling unification. The way you would understand gauge coupling unification, go back to SO10. In SO10, if you go through a Patti-Salam phase and then go down to the standard model, then you don't necessarily get gauge coupling unification. So how does it work then? Is you have to have break first down to SO10 to SU5. If you do that, you're guaranteed to get gauge coupling unification to work. And then the symmetry breaking, which would have gotten you down to Patti-Salam, just breaks you down to the standard model. So you don't have to have a Patti-Salam intermediate phase. Okay, you just go from SO10 to SU5 to the standard model. But the charge assignments of Patti-Salam are very important, and I'll come back to that right now. Eukaryotic unification. Question?
Yeah, and in the heterotic models, we were going to have to do the breaking by Wilson lines.
Yes.
Would it be possible to go from SO10 to Patti-Salam to the standard model, or do you kind of have to have
yes.
A set of Wilson lines?
You can, I'll show you that. Okay, Eukaryotic unification. How does it work? In SU5, the quarks and leptons are in tens and five bars of SU5. The Higgses are in fives and five bars. HU, I'm calling a five of Higgses. and HD I'm calling a 5-bar of Higgs's, okay? This is where the up and down Higgs for the electroweak theory are contained in these H up and H down. In SU5, you have three possible invariant couplings, and so there's no relationship between lambda up, the up quark mass, the down and tau mass would be, or the bottom and tau mass would be here, and neutrino mass, the one which you give a Dirac neutrino mass, is in here, and they're not related. They're totally independent. However, in either Patisalam or SO10, you have only one Yukawa coupling that you can write down. I write it down here explicitly in a Patisalam language, where Q bar is the state that you saw before, 4 bar, 1, 2, a doublet under SU2 right, Q is a 4, 2, 1, a doublet under SU2 left, and this Patisalam Higgs is a 1, 2, 2. It's a doublet under SU2 left, it's a doublet under SU2 right, and in fact it just combines the H up and H down into one fourplet. So it's all there in Patisalam. Since there's only one Yukawa coupling, you get this relationship, the top, bottom, tau, nu, neutrino, Yukawa couplings for the Dirac masses are all equal to one coupling constant. Now that would be relevant for the next discussion. And the next discussion is neutrino masses. Neutrino masses in the standard model, you can think of neutrino masses as an effective dimension 5 operator, where you have two Higgs's and two lepton fermionic doublets there. So you have to have an effective 1 over mass coming, and where that typically is argued to come from is a Seesaw mechanism, where you have a right-handed sterile neutrino in this graph, and if you give this right-handed sterile neutrino a large mass, then the fermionic propagator is just 1 over a mass, you pull that out, you get Yukawa coupling here and here, that's just lambda nu, so you get the 1 over the effective mass for this dimension 5 operator is naturally lambda nu squared over m nu bar, the mass, the Majorana mass for this right-handed neutrino. If you take lambda nu equal to lambda top, which you would get in a Patisalam or SO10 symmetry limit, then you can show that m nu bar is around 10 to the 14 GeV, which is, as people would argue, is near the gut scale, so you're happy. You have another indication of a grand unification scale. You might argue that it's of order 1/100th of the gut scale, so there's a problem, but there's not necessarily a problem. But before I get into that, let me just make the following statement. If you don't have any, the top quark Yukawa coupling is the largest Yukawa coupling in the theory as far as we know. It's a number at the gut scale of order 1. It's like 0.6, 0.7. If you had an SU5 theory and the neutrino Dirac Yukawa coupling wasn't related to the top quark Yukawa coupling, then you might expect it to be could be much less than the top quark Yukawa coupling. If that coupling was much less than the top quark Yukawa coupling, then this number would have to be much smaller in order to get, by the way, where am I getting this from? I guess I didn't put this in. I left that out. I was rushing too much. Where do I get this from? If I ask that I get atmospheric neutrino oscillations, okay, in the standard way from a normal hierarchy of neutrinos, then the atmospheric neutrino mass squared splitting is around 0.05 electron volts squared. If I take that 0.05 electron volts and associate it with the tau neutrino, the heaviest neutrino in a normal hierarchy, then I say that this mass at lambda nu squared v squared over m nu bar has to be that 0.05 electron volts, and that's where I get m nu bars of order 10 to the 14 GeV. So I left several steps out of here. But anyway, you only get that if you say that this is smaller, then this is going to have to be smaller too, and you get much less agreement with grand unification. So it comes naturally with an SO10. Why I'm not worried about this is because what this is saying is that m nu bars around something like the guts scale squared divided by the Planck scale, an order of two orders of magnitude suppression. And that might be natural, for example, in an SO10 theory, where you have, imagine, you have to have some effective higher dimensional operator give you a Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrino that's in the 16, okay? So this guy here is sitting in the 16-dimensional representation of SO10. You have to break SO10 down to SU5, like I said before, in order to get grand unification to work. And you do that by, say, the vacuum expectation value of a 16 bar. Before you ask the question, let me just finish. The 16 bar has this effective right-handed neutrino in it, If it gets a vacuum excitation value, that's a singlet under SU5. And so that singlet can get a VEV under SU, which is a singlet under SU5. You give this guy a VEV, it will break naturally SO10 to SU5. Okay? And it will give that a mass. Now, if you have a Majorana mass for some singlet here, S, which couples 16 bar to 16 in a renormalizable type of interaction, and this coupling is of order 1, then when this guy gets a VEV, it gives a mass to the right-handed neutrinos, which is a seesaw mass, which is of order m gut squared divided by the singlet mass, which is naturally of order the larger scale in the theory. Question?
I have two problems with remedial questions. One is the relation for couplings you complained about. If that's true for all three generations, does it cause problems with the two larger ones?
Yes, sure would.
Okay.
So I'll come back to that, but okay.
Okay, and the second question was if the neutrino mass hierarchy is actually inverted,
then these theories typically predict a normal hierarchy. And it's not that it's difficult to get an inverted hierarchy. In fact, we've been able to get inverted hierarchies out of SO10, but when we do, we get the wrong mixing relationships, and they're sort of forced on us. Okay, so the bottom line out of going through this phenomenological sequence is to say that you might want to look, when you look in some more fundamental theory, build this on to something else which is more fundamental than all this, you'll look for an SO10 supersymmetric gut with low energy supersymmetry. Now, some people in the audience were more phenomenologically inclined. They might say, well, what about split supersymmetry? But since I don't expect to get that question, let me just answer it here. If you look at the literature for split supersymmetry, which I've done, there's a nice paper by Romanino and Giudice which show you, in order to get gauge coupling unification in a split scenario, the scalar masses have to be of order 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 GeV. That's nowhere near a string scale or a Planck scale, some intermediate scale, and it's hard to understand even within the split supersymmetry context why should you have that as an intermediate scale as opposed to a weak scale. So that's why I'm going to argue here that we're going to talk about low energy supersymmetry. Okay, now the question about what about the all three families of quarks and leptons? Well, I would argue that the masses, first of all, are naturally hierarchical, that you have, well, the masses are hierarchical, that's visible, that's observable. You have the third generation, which is heavier than the second generation, which is heavier than the first generation. And so, in fact, the top quark is the heaviest of them all, so you might at least look for a order 1 Yukawa coupling for the third generation top quark. That would have to be in your theory, so when you construct a string theory, you want to look for that also. Then the question is, you also know that the CKM matrix is hierarchical. Okay, so it mixes things weaker, but when they're twice as far as when they're only once adjacent. And so the natural mechanism that people look for when they discuss fermion masses in a hierarchical situation is this Fogart-Nielsen mechanism where you say that you have three families of quarks. I'm only using the up quarks here as an example. You have three families of, say, up quarks, left-handed and left-handed anti-up quarks, coupled to the Higgs. And the coupling is proportional to some set of singlets. It doesn't have to be a single singlet. Set of singlets is an effective higher dimensional operator divided by some effect fundamental scale in your theory. So let's say singlet divided by M Planck. And the power here, or the number of singlets that appears here, depends on which state you have here in the first, second, or third family. Now, there's many ways of doing this. Typically, it requires a flavor symmetry, and you have flavor symmetry breaking. And then which flavor symmetry you have is up to you. So the model building people look at all these possibilities. Lots of people have looked at U1 flavor symmetries, either anomaly-free or anomalous U1 flavor symmetries. Other people have looked at non-abelian symmetries, either SU2 or SU3, which these are flavor symmetries among the three families, or some discrete non-abelian symmetries. Okay. I'm going to argue later that probably you want to look for something like a discrete non-abelian flavor symmetry. And I'll give you several reasons for that. There's something else you have to know, that there's a Suzy flavor problem. As my friend Savas would like to say, there's about 125 soft Susy breaking parameters in the theory. Of course, I think that's a straw man, because what it means is that you have to find a clever supersymmetry breaking scenario which doesn't have all those parameters. And there's several out there, so the question is which one is right. But at any rate, you have to find something which has minimizes flavor-changing neutral currents. Of course, they come from the fact that you have squawks and quarks, the scalar quarks and the quarks, which in a supersymmetric limit are related to each other, so the flavor symmetry of the quarks are carried by the scalar quarks as well. But when we do supersymmetry breaking, you want to sort of keep that relationship. Otherwise, you can really screw up, generate flavor-changing neutral currents at low energies by loops, loop diagrams. If the quarks, when they're diagonalized, the quarks are not diagonalized, or vice versa, you can get loops which screw up flavor symmetries. The natural solution to these problems exists in the literature. You can have heavy first and second generation scalars, because the largest problems come from processes like mu goes to e gamma, or k long goes to mu nu, or such things like this, which contain the first and second families, or kk bar mixing, etc. You have the first and second families are the most stringently constrained, but of course they would give you first and second generation squawks and subtons in the loops, and if they're very heavy, those are suppressed. And other possibilities have degenerate squawk and subton masses at the gut scale. This is what sometimes people call minimal flavor violation. Then the only flavor violation you can, if you have degenerate squawks and subtons, I don't mean that they're all degenerate, I mean in a charge sector, they're degenerate. All the up squawks, left-handed up squawks, the three families are degenerate. The left-handed down squawks are degenerate, but not necessarily degenerate with each other. If you have that at the gut scale, then any rotation that you have to do on the fermions to diagonalize the fermion mass matrix commutes with the squawk mass matrices, and so they're diagonalized in the same basis. So that's another way of getting minimizing the amount of flavor violation. And finally, people talk about alignment of fermions and spermions. And what that means is that you have to have all off-diagonal elements in the fermion mass matrix. If the off-diagonal elements, if the scalar mass matrix was proportional to the fermion mass matrix, then when you diagonalize the fermion mass matrix, you would also diagonalize the scalar mass matrix, and you have no problem again. Of course, if you have U1 symmetries, which gave you this hierarchy, then U1 symmetries don't tell you that the scalar masses are flavor diagonal in the different charge sectors. In other words, different charge sectors, but the first, second, and third generations, that unit matrix is not necessarily a unit matrix. It's just diagonal with U1 symmetries. But if you have non-abelian flavor symmetries, then it can guarantee you that that matrix that you start out with for scalar masses, if you started out with a large scalar mass, that it's diagonal, and you then can have off-diagonal terms which are aligned. So I think both of these mechanisms can work together if you have non-abelian flavor symmetries, like SU2 or SU3. Then why would you look at non-abelian discrete flavor symmetries? Well, if you have non-abelian flavor symmetries in supersymmetric theories, then you can have D-term symmetry breaking. And if those non-abelian flavor symmetries, like SU2 or SU3, if those D-terms are non-zero, in other words, they're part of the supersymmetry breaking sector, then again, you split the different families, the scalar masses, and you're back into the same soup. And so the best thing is to have discrete non-abelian flavor symmetries, because you don't have D terms. Okay, so that's why I like to think of discrete non-abelian flavor symmetries.
You can find solutions
here. Absolutely, you can always do that.
For your first point, how heavy does heavy mean?
In the models that we've written down, which agree with all the data, we're talking about 3 to 5 TeV.
For the
That's right. So if you keep the third generation squawks and subtons light, less than a TeV, but the first two generations heavy, then you have no problem. Okay, so the summary now is that you have SO10 Susy get low energy supersymmetry and discrete non-abelian flavor symmetries. Of course, there's all other problems with four-dimensional guts, so let me discuss those problems. You have to do gut symmetry breaking. That requires, anybody who's worked out a four-dimensional gut and dug with SO10 or SU5 and did gut symmetry breaking knows that that part of the theory looks pretty ugly, and you typically don't want to include it in all your papers. You put it in the first paper and then leave it out all the rest so you can do it, because it's pretty ugly. At the same time, what you have to do is you have to split the doublet and triplet Higgses, because you have to have the color triplets in SU5. Higgses come in a 5 and a 5 bar of SU5. There are color triplet Higgses and Higgs doublets. You want the Higgs doublets to be light of order of the weak scale, their masses to be of order of the weak scale, determined by some mu parameter. But the color triplet Higgses have to be heavy, okay? And in fact, they have to be of order, their masses have to be of order of the Planck scale, in fact, or bigger than the gut scale, otherwise you run into problems with proton decay due to dimension 5 operators. Okay, so you have to split the Higgs doublets and triplets, and that's, again, a scenario which is not trivial, but it can be done in very natural ways. The first way that people did it was called minimal SU5, where you wrote down the simplest gut breaking sector in SU5, and then you wrote down some fine-tuning sector which can fine-tune the Higgs doublets to be light, with some singlet and scalar, or just some mass term, and an adjoint field gets a VEV. You can make the Higgs doublets light and the triplets heavy. Now, this theory has been ruled out, and the reason it's been ruled out is because it's very simple. And so you can do all the calculations, and particularly you can do the threshold corrections to the gauge coupling unifications at the gut scale, and you convince yourself that the color triplet Higgses have to have mass of order 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 GeV in order to be consistent with grand unification of couplings, but then it contributes to proton decay at a horrendous rate, and so it's ruled out by either proton decay or gauge coupling unification. Depends on how you say it. But there are SU5 models in 4D which are more complicated. People like Altarelli, Ferruglio, and collaborators have written them down in great detail, or SO10 models, which we've written down in great detail, which can solve the double-triplet splitting problem and do gut symmetry breaking at the same time and get gauge coupling unification to work. It's just horrendous. Question?
How hard is it to get the triplets up at the Planck scale as opposed to the gut scale?
It's not hard. In fact, you can, and the reason it's not hard is because it's really not necessarily a color triplet mass that contributes to proton decay. It's an effective mass. You have to have a 3 and a 3 bar getting a mass term. And you can, in fact, suppress that so that the effective mass is enhanced, even though there's no color triplets with mass greater than the gut scale mass. So let me leave it like that, and we can discuss it later if you want. But the theories we've written down have no color triplets with mass greater than the gut scale, but the effective color triplet mass can be avoided at the Planck scale, no problem. And what you're doing is getting light doublets in your theory. So it's a little bit technical, and I don't want to go into detail there, but yeah, it's not a problem. There's a sort of seesaw mechanism that you can use. Okay, but so this, I do see this as somewhat of a problem. And in fact, for many years I was trying to build string theories from the heterotic string where you had guts in 4Ds, four dimensions coming out of the string. And in fact, you can do that. You can build, people have done that, people like Kakushadze and Tai build SU5 and SO10 grand unified theories coming out of the string, which have massless adjoints in the low energy theory. And the only problem is you got to go to higher Kac-Moody level in order to do that. So Kac-Moody level 3 was what they used. And that's not hard to get. You just take three SO10s, SO10 cubed, combine it together to a diagonal subgroup of SO10, and you get Kac-Moody level 3. So it's not hard. Not many people want to do that. It's a hard game to play, but they did it. So what's the problem? The problem is that you can do it, but you still, once you get down to 4D, you got to have a gut symmetry breaking sector. And I kind of started imagine that it's hard to get that coming out of the string, to get this gut symmetry breaking sector to come out of the string. And so the way I think is best to go is to do this, and that's orbifold guts. So that leads me into the next topic. I'm not going to teach you about orbifold guts. I'm just going to remind you about what you probably know about orbifold guts. So orbifold Suzy guts. What you do, let's imagine you start out with a five-dimensional or a six-dimensional field theory now. This is not a string theory. 5D or 6D field theory. And then you compactify the extra one or two dimensions on a circle or on a torus, which you then orbifold, so you don't have a manifold anymore. You have some fixed points. Now, once you go to higher dimensions in supersymmetric theories, you know that if you're in five or six dimension supersymmetric theory, in terms of an effective 4D supersymmetric theory, you really have n equal to 2 supersymmetry. Okay? You have both left-handed and right-handed chiral fermions, and they're all in the same irreducible representations of the gauge groups, etc. So you have an n equal to 2 supersymmetry, and the orbifolding allows you to break that n equal to 2 down to n equal to 1 supersymmetry. The orbifolding also allows you to do gauge symmetry breaking via boundary conditions on your orbifolding, or via Wilson lines, depending on how you say it. In order to get a chiral gauge theory at low energies, you can't start out with n equal to 2. N equal to 2 in 4D is not chiral. In order to have chiral gauge theory, you have to do this breaking. But even if you didn't have for supersymmetry, you wouldn't have a chiral gauge theory unless you did orbifolding. In other words, if you just had fermions in five or six dimensions and broke down to four-dimensional field theory, we wouldn't have a chiral gauge theory. You'd have a real gauge theory. So to get chiral gauge theories, you have to do orbifolding. Get rid of the left-handed or right-handed components of these fermions via the orbifolding. And of course, you can do Higgs double-triplet splitting via orbifolding. So all the features that are problematic in 4D gauge theory, gauge symmetry breaking and Higgs double-triplet splitting, are very simple, or albeit ad hoc. I mean, there should be some dynamics behind this at some point. But it's simple in orbifold gauge theories. Now, you know this, that all this is first observed in heterotic strings in 10 dimensions. So I'm not teaching the string people anything, but the field theory people had a lot of few years of great fun building orbifold guts, okay, and seeing how easy it is to construct realistic models. Okay, that leads us to the E8, cos E8 heterotic string. And so what I want to do is construct some minimal supersymmetric standard model-like theories out of the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, and of course there are going to be some caveats just from the start so that you don't ask the questions later. Okay? We're going to look for supersymmetric solutions at of order the string or gut scale. Okay? I'm not going to worry at this moment about supersymmetry breaking, especially since if I believe it's a low energy supersymmetry breaking, it probably can be discussed in the effect of low energy field theory. And so that's where we would look for it. Of course, that's easier said than done, because still, even in this theory, you got hundreds of moduli, which are either singlets under the gauge groups or non-singlets under the gauge groups, geometric and other moduli. And at the moment, we know that the gauge and Yukawa couplings are functions of these moduli. Okay, so our effective higher dimensional Yukawa couplings, those singlets that appeared there, we'll now call them moduli in string theory. You always get these effective higher dimensional operators. It's natural in a string theory. And so it might be natural to get a hierarchy of fermion masses due to that. Of course, until we solve these problems, we don't know exactly what the values of those couplings are. So we'll use our ignorance now to just tune those singlets to the desired values to give you the, if we can tune those singlets, the hope is we can find a theory where we can tune those singlets at this moment to the desired values to give you the right Yukawa couplings for quarks and leptons, okay? Without saying how those values, and presumably they're in F or D flat directions, okay? How that gets fixed, we won't tell you yet, because I don't know. So moduli stabilization and Suzy breaking are a problem, which hopefully can be addressed at a later date. To say it a different way, if with this caveat we don't find theories which look like the real world, then it doesn't care. We don't care about stabilizing the moduli in those theories, right? Because we already proved that the real world is not here. So the first step is to find the real world with arbitrary possibilities and then ask the question, can we get stabilized the moduli? By the way, there has to be a lot of string people starting to work in stabilizing moduli on the heterotic side of the aisle. Okay, there's the right wing and left wing. I don't know which wing you want to call yourselves in, but it would be nice if you choose to stabilize moduli on the heterotic side so I can figure out how to do this then in the theories that we're looking at. Anyway, we'll save this for later. So the outline for the rest of the talk is the following. Let's take first paper is this paper by Kobayashi, Renji Zhang, and myself, and the relationship between orbifold guts and string orbifolds. Okay, they're very nice, tight relationships, which for me gives me intuition on how to build string models that look like the real world. And then we'll discuss this paper that should be on the net tomorrow, Stringy Selection Rules and Discrete Flavor Symmetries by these authors. The author list gets bigger as we go on. Kobayashi, Nilis, Pfluger, myself, and Michael Rotz. And finally, the work that should maybe be on the network, on the web in a couple of weeks, has seven authors, Lebedev, Nilis, myself, Ramos Sanchez, Rotz, Bodra Wenger, and Achim Wingerder, who's sitting here in the audience. Okay, so that's the mini landscape search I'll discuss at the end. Okay, so let's discuss EA cross EA heterotic strings. Of course, you know that you can get SO10 with spinner representations out of this, so it's a nice starting point. We're going to have to compactify six dimensions on some tori. We're going to choose to compactify on this tori. Of course, every time I specify a, you know, something, there's lots of other possibilities. We haven't looked at all those possibilities, so there's lots of searching to be done. In fact, we specified a particular torus that looks something like this. This is the G2 lattice, which defines a torus. A torus is defined by a lattice, which you then mod out by the lattice vectors, an SU3 torus, and an SO4 root lattice. We're going to assume that the size of these dimensions, the T moduli of these dimensions, are all small of order the string scale, but there's one large extra dimension, so that we can think of this as an orbifold gut, where this, when we compactify this down and this down, we're left with five-dimensional field theory. Okay, that's where you think of in terms of orbifold gut. Yeah. Yeah, what are the gut scale? Then mod by Z6, so we have to take this manifold, and mod out by some discrete symmetry, which has to be a symmetry of the lattice. Okay, so the choice of lattice is determined by what symmetry you want to mod out by. The symmetry of G2 is Z6, the symmetry of SU3 is Z3, and the symmetry of this is Z2 or anything you want, but we'll choose it to be Z2. And then you add Wilson lines to break you down further, the symmetries down further. And so the Z6 has to be embedded into the EA cross EA gauge lattice as a shift. And that's how, it doesn't have to be embedded as a shift. In fact, it could be embedded as a twist in the gauge lattice. But in fact, Akin is an expert on that, but we haven't figured out how to do that yet. So we're going to save that for another day. But it will embed it as people typically do as a shift in the gauge lattice. Okay. If you have questions about this, I can explain more detail later or now, but otherwise I'll just go on. Okay, so let's first consider modding out by a Z3. The Z3 acts only here and here. Okay, it doesn't act here at all. And so this will be completely left free. It would be sort of untwisted in the first orbifolding. Okay? And we'll put a Wilson line in this SU3 direction. So the Wilson line appears here and here. It has to appear both places by the symmetries of the lattice. Okay, so we put one Wilson line in. And when we do that, when we do the Z3 orbifolding with the Wilson line here, the Z3 orbifolding gives us these fixed points. So this would be the twisted sector as opposed to the untwisted sector of this theory. And there's three fixed points here, there's three fixed points here. And the bottom line is that you look for the massless modes of this theory. By the way, first statement is the massless modes from this untwisted sector and the G2 and SU3 twisted sectors correspond to these states, where V is the gauge hypermultiplet. So V is the gauge multiplet in n equal to one language. Sigma is a chiral multiplet in n equal to one language in the adjoint representation of E6. So it's a 78-dimensional representation, which is in the massless sector of this theory. There's a 27 and 27 bar, which is also in the untwisted sector. So these are all untwisted sector states. And these three, the three comes from the fact that they live at fixed point. They live at this, this, and this fixed point, and all live here in the twisted sector. Okay? Now, the point of this all is that all of these states, even these twisted sector states, are free to move around freely in this extra torus. Okay, so if you're thinking about orbital folds, what we're constructed so far is a six-dimensional or five-dimensional orbital fold field theory, which is an E6 field theory where we have all of these states living in this extra dimension.
Four generations.
You might think of these as generations, but I don't think of them as generations. We'll get back to that. Okay. We'll only get one generation out of these what I call bulk states of my orbital fold field theory. In order to see this in a more technical way, and I'm showing this not because you don't know this, but because I want to show you how intuitive it can be to construct these theories. We have to start out with an EA cross E8 set of states, which is written on an EA cross E8 lattice. Okay, and the momenta which define the states on the EA cross E8 lattice satisfy these conditions. They're either an eight-dimensional vector. I'm looking only at one E8. So it's either an eight-dimensional vector with all integers here, or an eight-dimensional vector with all half integers here. Those are the EA cross CE8 lattice. Okay, subject to the condition that all the ends are integers and the sum on the ends are equal to twice an integer. Okay, is EA the even lattice. Massless states in the untwisted sector satisfy p squared equal to 2. So you don't have large momenta in this lattice, okay, which defines the states. And then you have to project out states which are invariant under the twist. The twist is a combination of acting on the spatial components of the theory, the right movers, and acting on the gauge components of the theory, the left movers. And this is the twist that we use, or the shift vector that we used in the E8 lattice. It's V6, which is 1, 6, 2, 2, 2, 0, 0, 0. Okay? It satisfies the fact that under Z6, 6 times V6 equals a lattice vector in E8. So it doesn't change anything once you take 6 times V6. Gives you another lattice vector. V3, the orbital fold that I'm discussing right now, is just a Z3 orbital fold. The V3 is just 2 times this V6. Okay, so it has a Z3 symmetry. The GSO projection, or the projection onto physical states in the untwisted sector, is just a statement that P, this lattice vector, times V3 minus R, where R is any one of these possible vectors. Either this happens to be taking your fermions in your right movers and bosonize them, and these are the momentum associated with the Neuwirth-Schwarz fermions. Okay. The momentum vectors just live on an E8 or SO8 lattice, the transverse lattice in this discussion. And so if I talk about a U1 twisted sector, I'm talking about having momentum 1 here. If I'm talking about a U2 twisted sector, I'm talking about momentum here. If I'm talking about a U3 twisted sector, I'm talking about momentum here. If I'm talking about the gauge sector of the theory, they have momentum which correspond to a physical transverse coordinates, and so those are the uncompactified dimensions. Okay, that's the first vector here. The twist vector, the Z3 twist, is just a simple thing which acts on the first torus and then on the second torus in terms of a phase rotation. So the twist is actually a phase rotation by amount e to the 2 pi I V3, which acts on the complexified first and second torus alone. And you look for states which satisfy this condition, that P dot V3 minus R, this vector, times nu3 is equal to z. That's what you look for. The solution is, let's just look at P dot V3 equals an integer. These are the solutions. They have to satisfy P squared equals 2, okay? And so this has to have 2 ones in it, or 8 halves in it, and you get P squared equal to 2. And then you look for, you take the specific V3, I'm not going to go back to that, you'll just take my word for it. These are the vectors, the unique vectors, which satisfy P dot V3 as an integer. This happens to be, now you've already seen this, these states are the 45-dimensional representation of SO10. These states are just the spinner or anti-spinner representation, because you can have a plus or a minus sign here, of SO10. And together, this forms into representation, the adjoint representation of E6. So that's E6. It's a 45 plus a 16 plus a 16 bar. And then you have these extra states here, which happens to be the generators of an SU3 symmetry. So with just using this V3, in every place where it applied, you get an E6 cross SU3. So where does it apply? P dot V3 equals Z. Well, let's go back to the previous case. P dot V3 equals Z is only applicable when R dot V3 equals 0. Well, that's the case for the gauge sector, okay, where you have a 0 here. Those are the gauge states. Or say it another way, if I made this a 4 vector, there would have been a 0 here, and this could have been 1. I should have said it in the right way. This could have been 1, but this has a 0. I'm not twisting in the two transverse dimensions of space-time. And so for the gauge multiplet, this would have been 0. And it's also 0 for the third torus, the one that's not being affected by this symmetry twist. Okay? And that's where I get an n equal to 2 gauge theory coming out. So this is applicable for both these states and these states, which are the U3, the chiral multiplet is sitting in, has momentum in the third direction of that, the third torus. Okay, and that's the 78-dimensional representation. If I do this to the other states, I'll find out the 27 and 27 bar in the untwisted sector come in the one or second twisted sector. So it's very simple. You can do this by hand. You can actually have intuition on what symmetries you break down to. Okay, then you might add the Z2 orbifold, the extra question.
Yeah, at this stage, first of all, did you do any action on the free fermions that represent the hidden sector A or not?
Free fermions that represent the hidden sector E8. No, yes, you did. Because okay, so now I understand the question. Okay, so I'm treating all the, by the way, I'm treating all, so there was two parts I didn't understand in your question. I'm treating all the E8 cross E8 as bosonic instead of fermionic, but if I was treating it as fermionic, in effect, so now I understand the question. The answer is, yes, I had to do also a shift in that sector as well, but those shifts are constrained by modular invariance constraints. Okay? I don't care about it. And there's lots of choices. I mean, there's lots of freedom to break it in that sector to satisfy modular invariance constraints.
So my next question would be, this is, it looks a lot like this should just be some special version of the Hadamard string on K3 times T2 with some bundles in the 2E8. Have you identified which smooth for K3 times T2 is?
No, because that's at a language above mine.
Well, hopefully in the K3 times T2 description, there have to be interesting bundles.
Well, you need bundles here too for level 100.
Yeah, so you do have real strings here. They're just
here. Yeah? Okay, we'll have to discuss this afterwards. Okay, so now we're going to add the extra V2, the Z2 shift, and the Wilson line, and we'll put the Wilson line in this torus. They can actually have two Wilson lines, one in this direction, one in this direction. They're not coupled in any way. We'll just put the Wilson line in this direction, okay? So we break the symmetry going from this end of the theory to this end of the theory. States will be different at the two ends, but we won't break any symmetry in this direction because the Wilson line is orthogonal to it. If we do this orbifolding, we get those. These are the states which come out of the bulk states of the theory. So out of the adjoint multiplets, we get Patty Salaman now. 4D effective field theory we're now down to. We broke, by this Z2 orbifolding, we broke n equal to 2 down to n equal to 1 in the following ways. We can think of it as a parity operation coming from the V2 twist or shift, which breaks E6 down to SO10 and also breaks n equal to 2 down to n equal to 1 supersymmetry, because that's all that's left over once you now do the twisting on all three tori. And the Wilson line acting on this gets us from SO10 to Patty Salam. So V2 plus W2, which distinguishes this end and this end, gets you down to Patty Salam. So we have a Patty Salam effective 4D field theory. And the nice thing about Patty Salam is you don't really need complicated effective super potentials in order to break Patty Salam down to the standard model. It's pretty simple once you get there. Okay, and these are the states that come out of the bulk states that I talked about in the theory. These states, this is the Patty Salam gauge sector. This out of sigma, which is a 78-dimensional representation of E6, comes what I'll call the right left-handed antifermions, quarks and leptons of the third family. Out of the 27 comes the left-handed quarks and leptons of the third family. And out of the 27 bar contained a 10 bar of SO10, but a 10 bar is the same as a 10 of SO10, and that's where the Higgs comes out of. And in fact, it's very nice because all of these theories, states live in the bulk. They live in the 1/3 twisted sector, and there's a very simple cubic Yukawa coupling between these states. We'll get back to that. In the T1 twisted sector, where you just twist by V6 once, the whole Z6 twist once, you get one fixed point here, three fixed points here, and four fixed points in this sector because you have a Z2 twist. These two states are living on an SO10 fixed point, an SO10 invariant fixed point. So, and some people like to talk about it in terms of localized guts. We have Patty Salama 4D, but we have, at this fixed point, we have a complete SO10 theory with a multiplets which are in complete representations of SO10. So we have two 16s, there's two because there's two fixed points. At this end of the world, with these two fixed points, we get all of these other states. So I'm happy about this, two light families. Third family lives in the bulk. We have two light families living at these two fixed points. I'm not totally happy about this. Those are vector-like exotics. But the nice part is, one, you can count them. There's a very few number of states which are charge and anti-charge. Okay, that's why they're vector-like. It means that they can get mass at some high scale without affecting, breaking any symmetries of the low energy theory. If you had chiral exotics, it means they can't get mass without breaking any symmetry. They could be a problem. But vector-like exotics, in principle, if you can give them all mass with singlet VEVs, these moduli getting VEVs, you can give them large mass, or they can have mass of just above the LHC or just in the LHC range. I don't know. You choose. But there's lots of possibilities here. But you do get these vector-like exotics, and there's very few of them. Okay, so to summarize, we have third family in the bulk. We get gauge Yukawa unification. Because all of these states are coming out of the bulk, their coupling constant in n equal to 2 field theories, the superpotential for the n equal to 2 field theory is just the gauge coupling. And so that coupling just tells you that the gauge coupling is equal to the Yukawa coupling for the third family. It's naturally of order 1. First and second families live on a Z2 fixed point. It turns out there's a D4 family symmetry, a non-abelian discrete family symmetry, which is natural. And I'll come back to that. And those other states that were there are not terrible because those, this chi c and chi c bar, well, chi c has the exact same quantum numbers as what I call family, right, left-handed anti-quark family. Okay, that's the family that contains the right-handed neutrino. If the right-handed neutrino got a VEV, if one of these fields got a VEV, that spontaneously breaks Patty Salama down to the standard model. So you need these states, they're there, in fact, to break Patty Salama down to the standard model, so you're very happy. All you need is a superpotential which couples them in a way that you can get large VEVs of order the gut scale for these gut fields. Okay? So Higgs is for Patty Salama symmetry breaking, absolutely necessary if you go this route. Let me go back to discrete family symmetries, non-abelian family symmetries. This is that extra dimension, right? It's a circle. Forget about the fifth dimension. There was a circle in the sixth dimension that the two families are living on opposite ends of that circle. Those are the two fixed points. Okay, that's the torus. Of course, there's a complete symmetry of going around the circle. That's what he started out with. So there's no difference between this state and this state. Okay, that's where D4 family symmetry comes from. It comes from the combination of geometry saying that the two states living at the two different fixed points are geometrically totally equivalent. You can't distinguish them because the Wilson line is orthogonal. So there's a geometric interchange of those two states, and the string theory has to satisfy that. In addition, there's this, which comes from what's called space group selection rules, which says that you have to have an even number of these states at every point, okay, either on one fixed point or the other fixed point. By the way, singlet states can live either at one fixed point or the other fixed point. I would call them doublets under the D4 family symmetry, and if they get VEVs, they spontaneously break D4 down to something lower. So that would be good. The third family lives in the bulk, so it's a singlet under D4 family symmetry. The first two families live on those two fixed points. A D4 family, this is just schematic, a D4 family symmetry can be used in a hierarchical way to break, spontaneously break, down to the right hierarchy of Fermat masses and mixing angles. Not to say that we've done this, although there's work in progress with Kobayashi and other collaborators. Let me get into more general discussion now. So these are all the possible orbifolds that you can use on lots of different geometric orbifold spaces. There's a lot in the literature. We've just looked at, now what we've been discussing, Z2 cross Z3 is equivalent to Z6-2, okay? Z6-2 can be thought of as this Z2 cross Z3. It's one-to-one correspondence between the fixed, the twisted sectors of one and the other, okay? So that's one way of talking about it. So there's lots of other possibilities to look at. I'm going to focus on Z6-2, though, in the rest of the talk. Okay, so you start out in general with orbifold and twisted sectors. So the orbifold, you start out with a torus with some space group translations, which identifies points at opposite ends of the torus. This is, in this case, would be a six-dimensional space that we're compactifying on. The torus is just the full d-dimensional space divided by the lattice shifts. And then we've defined some twists on this lattice. The twists have to satisfy theta to some power is equal to 1. There can be a set of two twists which give you n equal to 1 supersymmetry. So this would be describing a Zn orbifold. There are fixed points. Fixed points on the orbifold mean that if you make a twist on a state, it comes back to the state up to some lattice shift. Okay? So you have to, usually you have to shift by some lattice to get back to that same point. Those define the fixed points in the kth twisted sector. And there are conjugacy classes of fixed points. In other words, in the case of the circle, I can't go from one fixed point to the other fixed point by a full lattice shift, because the lattice shift takes me around the circle. Okay? So there are two conjugacy classes, two inequivalent fixed points. Okay, so we have to talk about conjugacy classes. So here's a T2 over Z3 orbifold. You start out with an SU3 lattice. And you look for the conjugacy classes where theta gives you 120-degree rotation on the lattice. The conjugacy classes defined by the lattice vectors, which are E1 and E2, are spanned by 3E1, three times this lattice vector, and the difference E2 minus E1. It means that the fixed points come in three different conjugacy classes. They can either be M1 equal to 0, sitting there, M1 equal to 1, meaning you had to shift by one lattice vector to get back here, E1, or M1 equal to 2, it doesn't look like, but you have to shift by two of these E1s to get back here, plus some of this, okay, to get back there. But this is arbitrary integer you can use to do the shifts. And there are three arbitrary fixed points determined by the three conjugacy classes. The stringy selection rules say that vertex couplings exist only if the product of the representative orbifold fixed points for each state, the product on each state I equals 1 to n for each fixed point, satisfies the property that it's in the zero conjugacy class. No, you haven't done anything. So it's unity under this, so that means that little n has to be equal to 3 times an integer for Z3 orbifold. And this has to be in these conjugacy classes, meaning that the sum on M1i has to be trivial, has to be 0 mod 3. Okay. We're going to now represent these selection rules in terms of symmetry operations on the three twisted sector states. And so these are space group selection rules. The representation now is that the point group selection rule just says that you have to have any one of these states has to be there three times, so that you get theta cubed. Okay. So we just associate with each one of these states the same angle omega, which is the cube, the third root of identity. The other one, the other space group selection rule, says that the sum of these indices here have to add up to 0 mod 3. And we can do that by saying that there's a multiplicative operation on these three states which distinguish them, such that this is 1, this is omega and omega squared. Those are the two space group selection rules. But then this is a torus after all, and all three fixed points are identical. Unless we put Wilson lines in there, there's nothing to distinguish these fixed points. So you can rotate that torus by 120-degree angle, and that just gives you a permutation of these fixed points. Okay, so that's geometry, the S3 permutations of geometrical. Putting together the geometrical transformations, which is an S3, with these transformations, which are two Z3s, we get the product or the the union of all of these operations just gives you the group delta 54. So you get this non-trivial discrete subgroup of SU3 called delta 54 as a symmetry group of this T2 over Z3 orbifold.
I'm sorry, why is it delta 54 and not delta 47?
It's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you, but it is delta 54. I mean, the number of generators that you get by taking the union of all those operations is equal to the number of generators you need for delta 54, which I think is 54.
Those three operations?
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about it.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm running over time, so let me jump through these, and I'm not going to discuss these. You can look at other symmetries of different systems. If you give this guy that sits here a VEV, you then only have these two guys, which you can transform from among, and that breaks delta 54 down to D3. So you can have a D3, a doublet under a D3 symmetry. D3 is isomorphic to S3. I'm going to skip through all this, because I want to get to the last subject, and I see I'm starting to run over. Anyway, this will be coming on the web tomorrow. Okay, so the final subject I want to discuss is search for minimal supersymmetric standard model spectra in the heterotic orbifolds. Okay, so now we're going to try to break down to a four-dimensional standard model gauge group. Okay, not going through Patty-Solomon 4D. Buchmuller, Hamaguchi, Lebedev, and Rotz have taken our Z62 orbifold, the same orbifold, but with different Wilson lines, are able to break down directly to four-dimensional standard model with three families of quarks and leptons with vector-like exotics, and they wrote down several papers with a couple of examples of that. And what we're doing is now starting from this starting point to see how many models we can get in this direction. Okay, so this is a collaboration of these seven authors, and we call it mini landscape search. So these are the steps that we use. We use a V6, a shift vector, and the E8 lattice, which breaks either to SO10 or E6 directly. The one I showed you, when you use both V3 and V2 together, you break down to SO10. Okay, here we allow for other possible, there's in fact two V6s which can break down to SO10 and two V6s which can break down to E6. We ask that two families in an SO10 language, two 16s live in the T1 twisted sector states, just where I said they lived in our model. Okay, that's exactly where they live in the Buchmuller AL models. Okay, the two families are in those two fixed points. These authors, the Buchmuller et al., have studied the question of what happens if you try to put three families at the three fixed points on the SU3 torus. They've asked that question. They find that every time they do that, and this is a numerical analysis, a search, every time they try to put three families on those three twisted sectors, you can break down to the standard model, but you get chiral exotics. So there was a no-go theorem in this case. Okay, I don't know how general that is. Probably none of this is too general. You have to start looking at other orbifolds. But anyway, so that's why we're looking for putting these two families on the two fixed points, and then the third family comes out of partially out of a bulk and partially out of a fixed point, out of a T2 fixed point typically, I think. Okay, now we generate all possible two Wilson lines, W3 and W2, which are consistent with modular invariance constraints. And we identify the massless sectors of the theory, and we ask that we only look at inequivalent models. Now, inequivalent for us means there's a caveat here. It means that we have the same number of states with non-abelian charges. The right, you know, if we have three families, we have three 3-2s, three net 3-2s, et cetera. Exact same number of states with non-abelian charges, but we don't look at the abelian charges. They may be different as far as abelian charges are concerned. But if we get multiples with this, we throw them out. So there may be more states which are inequivalent when we start looking at the U1 charges. Okay? We also don't care where these states are sitting. They may be sitting at different fixed points. We're just looking at the same number of states, and it makes a difference for your Cal couplings where the states sit. And so it's important. But we're looking, so when we identify inequivalent models, it's the lower limit of how many inequivalent models there actually are. Now we select models with this symmetry breaking pattern. If there was an E6 here, E6 breaks SO10, SO10 breaks SU5, and then you break down to the standard model. These states in this first twisted sector are not affected by any of this breaking because it's done by Wilson lines that don't affect them. So you're left with the full spinner representation of SO10. We select models with 3 net 3 2s. We select models with non-anomalous U1 hypercharge, which is contained normally in SU5, in the normal SU5. And then we select models with 3 standard model families and Higgsers and vector-like exotics only. Okay, question?
Some of your inequivalent models could well just run, say, moduli space at different points.
Yes, yeah. That's probably, yeah, and some of them, if they have different U1 charges, maybe if we redefine the U1s, they're the same. But if they live at different fixed points, maybe they're related by symmetries. We don't know, but we've thrown out.
So you need the 3 3 2s for just the
quarks, doublets. These are SU3 cross SU2. No, it's simple. Okay, so this is the result so far. So this is all preliminary. Step four, we require inequivalent models with 2 Wilson lines. We find 22,142 such models with this V6 shift vector, 7,800 with this V6 shift vector. These two break you down to SO10. These two break you down to E6, and we have fewer models at that level. Then we ask that the standard model gauge group is contained in these as a subset. We break this down by a factor of 7, essentially, 3,000 models, 1,000. We ask that there are 3 net. In other words, there can be 7 3-2s and 4 3-bar 2s. That equals 3 net. The others would be vector-like exotics. We don't worry about them. 1,000, et cetera. Non-anomalous U1 hypercharge, that number, that you ask that their hypercharge is vector-like, that there are no chiral exotics. Chiral exotics, which have non-standard model hypercharge, are fractionally charged states. And if they're chiral exotics, they can't get mass. Or they can get mass when Higgs, if they're lucky, they can get mass with some other chiral exotics when the Higgs gets a vent. But they all have to either be massless or at the weak scale or below. So that was why there's a problem with chiral exotics. So we look for vector-like exotics. Okay, there's another 2 steps. We ask that at least one family of up quarks has an order 1 cubic eukaryotic coupling. We break it down by a factor of 2 from what we had before. And then we ask the next question that we ask, if I have an exotic and an exotic bar, I then ask for a superpotential term which has a number of singlets in it, which is invariant under U1 gauge symmetries, all the gauge symmetries, is invariant under space group selection rules, and we assume that the singlets can get arbitrary vents. We haven't checked for supersymmetric flat directions yet. And we get down to 56 models here, 32 models here. So the probability is about 1 in 400 starting out from these theories for MSSM-like models. And this is a subset that we would start looking at now to see if we can get something that looks realistic with arbitrary values for these depths. Of course, we would probably want to do more. So what we're arguing is that this is a very fertile patch in the heterotic landscape. Future work, we got to check for D equals F equals 0 directions, okay? And we would only want, once we check for those directions, check all the exotics get mass, that they can get mass. Check fermion masses. By the way, there are anomalous U1s which would force some of these singlets to give VEVs at very large scale. Check fermion masses once you look for these directions, because fermion masses are related to higher order operators with all these same singlets in them. Check to see if we have R parity conservation in this theory. Check neutrino masses means that you get a Majorana mass for right-handed neutrinos. Okay? Now these two are actually connected. At this level, we can find theories which have B minus L charge for all the fields which are, We can find states with B minus L charge plus or minus 2, which can give right-handed neutrinos a mass without breaking our parity, if they get a VIP. So, but we have to check that it all works. We have to check, clearly the last thing is check Suzy breaking and lifting flat directions, which I don't know how to do at the moment. Conclusions, we have an SO10 Suzy gut with low energy supersymmetry. We've looked at an EA cross EA heterotic string. It seems to be a fertile patch of the landscape. We might find more fertile patches. For example, we're looking at Z2 cross Z4 with Akin and Vorderwanger. We can get the same multiplet structure. So it didn't depend on the fact that there was a Z3 in there at all, that you get three families. What's new between what we've done and what other people have done? I guess the motivation is different now of how to get three families. Previously, people originally looked at Z3 orbifolds because the number of fixed points are a multiple of three. So it's natural to get three families if you orbifold sufficiently. Problems with such theories, I've looked at a recent paper, a paper by Joel Geet, and the problem is that you break down to the standard model directly, and typically you find out that the theories have the wrong hypercharge assignments for things that you'd like to call standard model particles, and they typically have chiral exotics present. So it's hard to find standard model-like theories. The Z2 cross Z2 orbifolds have been done by in the free fermionic situation by Faraji. You have the reason why you get three here is because you have three twisted sectors. And I can explain that very easily if you want. And he starts out with an SO10 intermediate step, so he gets some things that look like the real world once you break it down to the standard model. What we're doing is Z6 cross Z2 cross equals Z2 cross Z3. The three families is equal to 2 plus 1. Two living at this fixed point, one living in the bulk. And we have localized SO10 gut and family symmetries that come out of it. And that's the end. Speechless.
What about those
polyphoric
gaps in each
dimension
without the
Sousa? What about orbifold guts
and actually in the Sousa?
Well, if the okay, so you're going to talk about a very large extra dimension, presumably, right? Well, yeah, I'm not sure how you're going to get guts to work without Sousa if you have this gut scales of order the Planck scale. Then you need Sousa to get the gauge scope unification to work right. Unless you have some warped extra dimension, in which case maybe you can do it, but they also have problems. I don't know. I mean, that's games that people can play. Suzy gives me the possibility of having all these flat directions, which I'd like to use in a good way. But then I eventually have to break supersymmetry at some low energy scale.
One is about what you're hoping will come out of the discrete symmetries. You mentioned arc parity, but you might have other kinds of, these are presumably, a lot of these are arc symmetries. They could group maybe dimension 5 operators that you don't want, and things like that. Or is your search program going to sort of look at all that, or what are you?
At the moment, right now, we're looking, as far as our parity is concerned, we're looking at this B minus L direction. But you're right. I mean, there's possibilities of getting R parities coming out of what's called H momentum conservation. Those typically give you R parities. The B minus L direction is what you call family reflection symmetry. That's all you need to get effectively an R parity, right? The quarks and leptons have charge minus 1, supersymmetric part fields. And Higgs's have charge 0, or plus 1, right? And that's what you get out of B minus L, because Higgs's have 0 B minus L and non-zero B minus L. Quarks and leptons have non-zero B minus L. Yeah. I don't know, so I'm not, we can look for it, but we haven't started doing it yet. By the way, we'll come out with a short paper in about a week, but then we'll continue to working on this and we'll end up with a longer paper later on.
Well, so there are all these experts here. Some comment at all? you know, why, you know, what's the difference between parallel spring and intersecting vernal construction and so on, or some kind of say, because this looks easy. This is the usual story. That's compared to those.
You never get 16 perturbatively in a dual type 2 description, so that, I mean, that's the main difference. There are dual type 2 descriptions for all of this, but what will always happen is there's a point of strong coupling with 16 arrests, or a locus of strong coupling. So, yeah, that, I mean, that's the sense in which you've got to look much more natural. I think this is, I mean, we can talk about this privately. I'm not sure most people don't care about this, but I think this is a very special construction using a special class of bundles on K3 times T2, and a lot of the features that you're discussing you could generalize and you can just classify because people know a lot about bundles on K3. So you can just give the full list of such models. On the other hand, your discrete symmetries come from the fact that you're sitting at this orbital point. So for that, it really matters that you wrote down the CFT exactly. So some things I think you could do much more generally.
A question I have is, I understand that to spontaneously breaks or to stabilize moduli in the heterotic string, you can go from, say, type 2 and figure out how it looks in the heterotic string, and then it looks like something like a non-Kähler half-flat manifold. And my question is, okay, that's been discussed, at least in the literature I've seen, that's been discussed in terms of Calabi-Yau language. Can I find a way of discussing that in a simple case in terms of something that's almost torus-like, almost orbifold-like, which is sort of a perturbative expansion away from a torus? Because then I can actually construct the string theory and ask how the perturbative corrections affect things.
Don't be afraid of Calabi-Yau.
I'm not afraid of Calabi-Yau, but I'm not sure I can get this much out of Calabi-Yau. I mean, this is can give me everything I want. And I know this is a deformation of Calabi-Yau to a singular limit, but this limit is very nice because it's free filtering. And the question is, can I take the these half-flat manifolds and write them as a free filter plus corrections? That would be very useful. I've looked at Andre Lucas's papers, but they're all written in this Calabi-Yau-like language, and I
don't think you're going to be able to use those.
Well, can I write down a three-dimensional torus, which then is deformed to give me something which is not Kähler or not flat? Because if I can write as a small perturbation on something which is flat, you know, pimple on something that is flat, then maybe I can do the calculation perturbatively.
This is what I'm saying. So you think of having like all the folds and then just putting a lump of bended metric on it or something. But I think that makes it difficult to get
one or two different things. Mm-hmm. What about the heterotic SO32? In fact, people have looked at that, and you can get spinner representations of SO10 out of the SO32. Aachen Wingert and collaborators wrote a paper on that. For years, I think they thought that you couldn't get spinner representations, but that was just the fact that they didn't look hard enough. You can get spinner representations of SO32. In fact, Kakushadze and Tai, when they constructed their SO10 models, they started with SO32, took SO32 and broke it up into SO10 cube cross SO2. And then SO10 cube, they took a diagonal subgroup of that to get SO10 at Casimir level 3, to get three families, because of Casimir level 3, three families and massless adjoints of SO10. So you can start with that. It's just that not very many people worked on that. And like I said, my only question there is, well, this orbifold language of the string theory is very nice because I can either get down to the standard model, I can get down to Patti Salam, but I can have guts at these fixed points. I can have gut symmetries and gut representations localized at these fixed points.
So I guess your philosophy at some point is we should not forget about
the Hilaronic stream.
Amen. That's not a philosophy, it's a statement that it might be, the real world might be there, you know? And so it might well be worth our while to spend some time looking there.
So you're comfortable with the thought that, well, maybe we don't need to look so carefully at some non-perturbative issues, brains or something like that? Or
No.
That you think somehow come in anyway to this picture?
No, all I'm saying now is that people are looking at non-perturbative issues in the context of type 2 strings, which is fine. Well, fluxes, I'm not sure how non-perturbative that is, but they're looking at fluxes, it's probably semi-classical description of type 2 strings, and it's probably a little bit more difficult in the heterotic string to understand how you stabilize moduli, etc. But I think that the real world, in terms of spectrum, gauge group, and spectrum of low energy theory, might be on that heterotic, or close to that heterotic point, and so it might be worthwhile to put the same effort into understanding the non-perturbative effects or stabilizing moduli in that sector.